www.jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Many people know the name of T. Rowe Price, and the man behind that name, Thomas Rowe Price Jr., is one of the most familiar and respected names in the investment world. And his story is a fascinating one, explored by someone who worked for many years for T. Rowe Price, his name, Cornelius C. Bond. And he has written a thorough and illuminating biography of T. Rowe Price titled T. Rowe Price, The Man, The Company, and The Investment Philosophy. The book is published by Wiley, and it sets out not only a lot of intriguing details about Mr. Price's personal life and his professional life, but also spells out some of the ways in which he really revolutionized the world of finance and investment. Cornelius C. Bond, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, and thank you very much for having me.
Happy to be talking with you. This has been really, really interesting. I would be somebody who knows the name of T. Rowe Price very well, having heard it time and time again, but had no idea really what that name really represented, and certainly had very little sense of the man himself. As you set about the task of writing this this book, this biography, you surely had at least some notion of just what an interesting story it is, but did you know how interesting?
Well, actually, when I got into the files and read a lot of the stuff they wrote back in the 30s and 40s, it really did cast more of a spotlight on the man himself behind just his wonderful investment performance.
One of the things you tell us in terms of his early years is that he was the son of a doctor, I believe the grandson of a doctor as well, and when he headed off to college, it was seemingly with the expectation of following in their footsteps, and then something happened. Tell us about that, in a sense, academic detour.
Actually, he was called a doctor in his high school book, and that was the course that he was on when he went to Swarthmore. He found, though, that he got more interested in other things. Maybe it was the tough biology courses. I'm not quite sure, but he settled on being a chemist, and his career really changed to investment when he worked for DuPont, which was one of the world's probably best managed and fastest growing companies in the world at that point in time.
Actually, one thing you tell us is that of the first three jobs he had, one of which was with DuPont, two of those companies ended up going out of business. And and you suggest that this was actually a very important learning experience for Mr. Price, and in a sense fueled his interest in how companies flourish or fail to flourish. And of course, having some sense of that was incredibly valuable in terms of what he went on to do.
Yes, exactly. As the first firm, went bankrupt due to some labor issues. The second firm went bankrupt because it defrauded its clients, and he was laid off. And as you point out, later went to work for DuPont, feeling that DuPont, being such a worldwide well-known company, was certainly not going to go bankrupt.
Tell us why when he first sort of dipped his toe into the world of finance by becoming a stockbroker after quite a long struggle, because he really had few, if any, credentials for landing a position as a stockbroker, but he eventually managed it with a firm, I believe, known as Smith & Lockhart, selling stocks, but he hated selling stocks. What was it about selling stocks that bothered him so much, or was it more that particular company and the way they did their business?
I'd say both. I think although he was an excellent salesman one-on-one, he preferred a more of an investment approach to someone to a portfolio. And the major thing that he found objectionable was true in those days and still remains true in most cases. The firm tended to push the stocks that were best for the firm in terms of it generating income for the firm, not best for the client. And Mr. Price was always focused on the client, on the client's well-being.
Eventually, Mr. Price landed a position with a different firm in 1925, a place with which he had a much more cordial relationship, but it was the place that from which he eventually severed ties because of kind of a disagreement over what was going to be a new division created within the company that Mr. Rowe himself would head up. Tell our listeners about this particular development. It's a really interesting moment in his story.
Yes, he ended up at McCubb & Legg, which is a venerable Baltimore firm, medium-sized, and worked directly for Mr. Legg, who was a principal partner there. His major ambition was to start and head up a division that would invest people's money in a way that built their portfolio over time. It was called investment management. It wasn't widely practiced at that point in time, and certainly was not practiced at all in Baltimore. He severed relations with the company really on two reasons. Number one, he continued to have the same problem with Legg that several of his senior partners wanted him to focus on companies that would generate more income for the firm as opposed to recommending companies to his clients that were good for them. Secondly, Mr. Price was a bit spoke his mind, a bit opinionated, even in his early years at Legg, and he alienated a number of the clients by essentially speaking the truth. The reason that he ultimately left was that 1937 was a pretty poor year in the stock market, and the firm had issued a number of bonds to its partners in the depths of the stock market decline, and they were quite concerned about the stock market and its impact on their own earnings and their own financial health, and so they were looking around for places to cut money. And this division that Mr. Price had just formed fell in the way of their wandering gaze. And the next thing he knew, Mr. Legg told him that they were unfortunately going to have to close down his division in the interest of saving money. I'm promising Mr. Price that longer term, of course, they did want to get back into the money management business. But he decided that the time had come to quit and do what he really loved, which was to manage other people's money. And he had learned that it was best to run the company himself. He didn't want a boss. He wanted to make sure that the company followed his ideas as far as investment were concerned, and particularly in service to the client, acting in the best interest of the client.
You tell us a lot about the formation of this new company in 1937. And one of the things I want to ask you about is the fact that there were women who played a very important role. And there were at least a couple of them who actually came with Mr. Price to his new firm. And I'm very intrigued, especially by the story of one Ms. Marie Walper, who really was in some ways an unsung heroine in this story of the birth of this company and its survival through those lean early years. Tell our listeners just a word about Ms. Marie Walper.
Yes, Marie was his secretary at Legg, and she was the became the first employee of the new firm when there wasn't even really a firm. She had confidence in Mr. Price, understood his problems at Legg, and agreed to go with him, even though obviously it was a pretty shaky time to join a new firm, particularly one in the financial business. But she took the leap with him. And you're right, she was the number two in the firm in many ways. She handled the books. She handled all the administration. She kept the files straight. She wrote the letters to clients. And she acted as his personal secretary. Importantly, when the firm later ran low on money, she would borrow from her own Christmas savings, for example, to donate a Christmas bonus to the firm, which Mr. Price many years later did repay in full. But at the moment in time, it was quite a sacrifice and showed her support for Mr. Price and the company.
I just love that story so much. I also appreciate, as you talk about some of the other key figures with the birth of T. Rowe Price and Associates, someone by the name of Charles Schaefer, who was one of his most important partners. And one of the things you highlight is that he was very different from Mr. Price, that in some ways, I suppose in personality and outlook, maybe they were in some ways almost opposites. And yet you say this is what made them a great team. And I think it probably says a lot about T. Rowe Price that he understood that it didn't necessarily make sense for him to surround himself with people who were just sort of carbon copies of himself, but that his business might be better if some of his associates had a very sort of different style and outlook.
Yes, that's true. And as you point out, many bosses can't accept a number two that's different from them. With Mr. Price, it was quite the opposite. He was a modest man and at heart, and he felt that he needed others to supplement areas which he regarded as not being strong. As I say, on a one-on-one basis, was a wonderful salesman, but he did not like to address groups. He was not a classical salesman in any sense of that word, but Charlie was. Charlie was just an outgoing guy, president of his fraternity, president of his class in college, and a wonderful tennis player and golf player. And he was the extrovert that Mr. Price was not. And together they just made a super team.
Mm. To circle back to something earlier in the book, you tell us that while Mr. Price was never a especially religious person, I mean, he was a churchgoer and certainly respected the notion of religion, but he was not fervently religious in the way that some people are. However, you suggest that in going to a Quaker school, he ended up incorporating some of the values of the so-called Quaker way into his adult life and into his professional life. That might be a nice segue into a closing summary of what his philosophy was and the way that he did business that was in such marked contrast to the way a lot of others in this field operated. And I suspect that this some of this Quaker influence might help explain his approach.
Well, that's true. He went to Friends School, which was a Quaker high school, and then later Swarthmore, which was founded by Quakers, although not a Quaker college. He respected his employees. He always hired women, which was part of the Quaker way. They believed that women were every bit as equal to men, which is an unusual thought in those days. And in fact, as you point out, two of the original employees of the five, two were women, two were men, and then there was Mr. Price. So, and the women rose quickly in the firm and had every bit the same salary and stock holdings as the men in terms of their position. He was a hardworking man. This was also a Quaker principle, and he believed in introducing new thoughts. He was innovative, which also the Quakers believed in. He certainly, in dealing with his clients, was extremely fierce, as I pointed out. He strongly believed in working hard and generating an outstanding performance. Investment performance. That was one of his key thoughts. He focused on buying the best stocks in the country, not the best stocks that might go up. He did not focus on the stock market. He focused on stocks. And he did this through what he called his growth stock philosophy. And I go into that in some detail. He felt that if the average person, the average investor, followed his growth stock philosophy, that he too could have a wonderful performance. Mr. Price had demonstrated that performance with his first fund, which was number one in the country in it for its first decade among all similar funds. His second fund, which he introduced 10 years later in 1960, in which I worked closely with him on, the New Horizons Fund became the best fund in the country as a whole. It was the very best mutual fund in its first 10 years of performance. And I did a quick check, incidentally, on these two funds, and they continue to be in the top 5% of all mutual funds, far outperforming the Standard & Poor's Index, which most funds, as you probably know, don't do today. He believed in providing his clients with the performance that many just promised. And that's certainly a Quaker philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Well, we learn much more about the high ethical way in which he conducted his business, the way in which his name became synonymous with the highest standards when it comes to the world of investment and of serving the client's needs first and foremost. It's a great story told in this book titled T. Rowe Price, The Man, the Company, and the Investment Philosophy, published by Wiley, the author Cornelius Bond. Mr. Bond, thank you so much for joining me on The Morning Show. I really enjoyed this conversation and learned so much from your book. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed the conversation.
It's 8:29. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. National Public Radio's coverage of the impeachment hearings in Washington will begin right around 9 o'clock. For part two of today's program, from the archives, you'll hear my conversation with highly regarded writer Bernard Cornwell, probably best known actually for his fiction. But on this instance, we are talking about a fine work of nonfiction he's responsible for called Waterloo, the history of 4 days, three battles, and three armies. And of course, it is the Battle of Waterloo that leads to the ultimate downfall of Napoleon Bonaparte. Here is a portion of our conversation. do a wonderful job of helping us understand who Napoleon was and, in a sense, sort of his state of affairs at the time that Waterloo was fought. In fact, you begin chapter one of the book by placing us on the tiny island of Elba. Remind our listeners about why Napoleon found himself as the leader of this minuscule island.
Tiny island, yes. Elba is a tiny island that lays between Corsica and Italy. It's a rather beautiful island, in fact. But remember that Napoleon had been a nuisance to Europe for some 20 years. And he'd finally been defeated in 1814. And he abdicated. And the conditions of his abdication were that he was made the ruler of Elba, which is, you know, it was really a very decent sentence, if you like. The trouble was the French, who were supposed to pay him a pension, that's going to keep him out of trouble, refused to pay the pension. And Napoleon decided, well, if you're not going to keep your side of the bargain, I won't keep mine either. And so early in 1815, he returned to France. And the French flocked to him. Suddenly there was a monarchy again, and the empire came back, and Napoleon was resurgent, and he had a huge army. Whereupon the rest of Europe ganged up on him.
Mm. One of the things I appreciated about the portrait you paint of Napoleon at this time on Elba is that he was bored and he was angry. And you've already pointed out that he was...
He had no money. He actually had great ambitions. He was a terrific administrator. He had great ambitions for the island. He wanted to resurrect his industry. He wanted to build schools and hospitals and roads. But he couldn't do any of those things because he wasn't being paid the money that had been agreed. So he really did have nothing to do. He was also very well aware that there was great dissatisfaction in France. In fact, in 1814, when he abdicated, the French were relieved to see him go. I mean, he caused countless deaths. And the French really were tired of war. And the last year of the war had been fought on French soil, so France itself had suffered badly. But even 6 months of the new royal government turned the French back again, being pro-Napoleon, because that Louis XVIII turned out to be really, or his administration turned out to be so inept. And Napoleon was aware of that. He was aware of great dissatisfaction in France. He was aware that the price of food had gone up, that there was great unemployment, that many of his veterans had nothing to do. And yeah, he was angry at what was happening to France. He was angry at what was happening to himself. But above all else, he was bored. He was a man who very easily got bored. He's an incredibly intelligent man. In many ways, a very enlightened one. I think he's a terrific administrator. If he had one huge fault, it is, I think, that he was in love with war.
Mm. Tell us about the color of violet. You write, during the winter of 1814 to 1815, many women in Paris wore violet-colored dresses. Not just fashion, but rather a code, which suggests...
Yes, the violet stood for, came in the spring. The violet was Napoleon's color. The one woman I think he really, truly loved was Josephine, the wonderful, beguiling Josephine. And on their wedding day, he gave her a bouquet of violets. She carried them up the aisle at her wedding. And on every anniversary of the wedding, he would send her a bouquet of violets. So the violet became a kind of code in royalist France, saying, I support Napoleon. And women would wear violet-colored dresses, and men would wear a violet in their buttonhole. And it was a little secret sign, saying, we're on Napoleon's side. And when, in fact, he did come back, people said that the violet had returned to France.
Hmm. So Napoleon's return to Paris... was that entirely unopposed?
It wasn't entirely unopposed. He was supposed to be opposed. I mean, Marshal Ney, his great general, who had decided to serve the king, set off to stop Napoleon. And there was a famous confrontation with the 5th Regiment of the Line. And they were supposed to capture Napoleon. And Napoleon sort of walked up to them and talked to them. And of course, they all started to cheer him. And in fact, the Royalist Army went over to Napoleon's side. Lock, stock, and barrel. In fact, they all deserted the king. A few of the officers stayed loyal. But the men were just pleased to have Napoleon back. Meanwhile, the veterans were all flocking to the colors, trying to get back into the army. He really wasn't, I mean, no shots were fired.
I love the story that you tell about Napoleon's return to the actual palace in Paris and what was done to the carpeting in the palace.
This is a Tuileries palace, and they knew he was coming. And a huge crowd had gathered to welcome him, and most of the sort of empire's nobility were up in the throne room. And the throne room had a very rich carpet. It was tufted, and each tuft was a crown. And somebody, obviously hating the monarchy, kicked at one of these crown tufts, and it came loose, and underneath it was a bee. I mean, woven into the carpet.
.35 We apologize for the technical difficulties with that issue. We're going to, with that particular interview, we'll share it another day. We want to remind you that NPR's coverage of the impeachment hearings will begin at 9 o'clock this morning. Here is a past interview from the archives at 8:35 here on WGTD. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, you're going to be hearing a brief yet illuminating conversation about brain tumors and about some of the extraordinary technological breakthroughs that have revolutionized the way in which doctors and surgeons can both diagnose and treat such tumors. My guest is Dr. Alfredo Quinonos Hinojosa, who is a neurosurgeon and chair of the Department of Neurologic Surgery at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida.
Tell us, sir, about some of the extraordinary breakthroughs that have occurred in recent years that make possible better diagnosis and treatment of brain tumors. I am especially interested in the usage of advanced imagery and even virtual reality. What are some of the most important ways in which these kind of technologies are being brought to bear?
Well, thank you very much, Greg. This is a very important question in the diagnosis of brain tumors. Doesn't matter what the brain tumor is, whether it's what we call a cancerous brain tumor or a benign brain tumor. I say that over the last two decades, you know, in the 70s, starting with CT scan, but then in the 80s with MRI. But then over the last two decades, there's been more and more utilization of imaging technology that allow us to go into the operating room and not only have something like a GPS system, already that allows to understand where the brain is in relationship to a tumor, where the tumor is in relationship to veins, arteries, nerves, and function, like ability to move your hand, your ability to speak, your ability to understand. So now we can go into the operating room and have a map, a layout of the land. So that way we do our surgery and cause the least amount of damage into a human brain that requires to be fully functional, of course. And then couple that with the intraoperative utilization of things like the intraoperative MRI that allows us to take a picture even before a high definition MRI that allows us to do and have an idea before we leave the operating room. On top of that, you mentioned the issue of virtual reality. I would say that the Mayo brothers, 153 plus years ago, they said that there's no reason why we should learn to do surgery in the human brain or the human body, because nowadays the technology allows us to do surgery even before we go into the operating room through virtual reality to 3D bioprinting. Not only can we understand where those dangerous spots are, where is that vein? Where is our artery? Where is speech? Ability to move your hand, your ability to open your eyes, your ability to see. So that way when you go in, you create a safe passage and you minimize injury to any of these structures. And now you can even print these models and hold them in your hand and be able to do that surgery before you go into the operating room. And of course, you can use this technology nowadays and incorporate it into your surgical planning. So that way, when you are navigating the brain live, you're also getting an image. It sounds like a movie out of a superhero movie where you get to use this technology. But that's where we are today, and mm-hmm. It is extraordinarily advanced, Greg.
Right. It's not science fiction anymore. It is science reality. One of the points that comes up again and again in what I have read about this is that much of this is about avoiding complications. And, of course, one can well imagine when we're talking about an organ as important as the brain, how even minor complications might lead to really terrible results. What kind of complications are we talking about that can be much more readily avoided utilizing this kind of technology?
Well, I would say that, as you know, the brain is still the unexplored frontier. One of the things that we have done over the last few years that I've been here at the Mayo Clinic in Florida is we created a multidisciplinary team that allows us to keep the patients awake and comfortable in the operating room so that way we can map their function. So if a tumor is near the speech area, not only your ability to produce speech, but your ability to understand speech. Imagine if you, in your attempts to try to take a tumor out, which, by the way, sometimes those tumors don't look different than the normal brain. So you have to make a decision, how much can you truly cut out of the brain? For us, keeping the patients awake allows us to understand where motor function is, ability to move your hand, leg, face, whatever it is, and be able to resect those tumors or preserve speech, you know, production, understanding of speech. So we have very effectively, you know, avoiding complications that are devastating. Imagine if you are a lawyer and your life is made out of making arguments in a oral or written form, and suddenly not being able to do so has a major consequence on a patient's life. Or imagine being a radio announcer or a brain surgeon like myself, and an inability to move your hands and to do things. It doesn't matter sometimes if you're taking tumors that are benign. If you cannot care for the normal brain, just the minimal amount of the wrong vessel being taken, the wrong vein being coagulated, can lead to devastating consequences for patients. So our goal is always to avoid that.
And quickly, the technological breakthroughs that we're talking about, of course, are not just part of the whole matter of treatment and surgery, but also, I should think, for diagnosis. We are in a much better position to better diagnose brain tumors because of some of this new technology.
Undoubtedly, Greg. Think about this. You know, nowadays, a patient comes in, I have an idea even before I go into the operating room as to what kind of tumor he or she may have, so that way I can tailor my surgery. Now, of course, at the end of the day, that tissue that we send from the operating room to a neuropathologist, you know, and then they tell us, this is what I think it is. It's extraordinarily vital information. But we know through functional MRI that that technology allows us to understand how a tumor may be affecting already parts of the brain that are crucial. So that way we can tailor our therapy. So this technology, as you said at the beginning, is no longer science fiction. It's a reality, and we're using it. And I think the next decade is going to be even more exciting with the use of artificial intelligence, machine learning that is being already incorporated in diagnosis and therapies. Just think about that. So the future is bright, and I always tell our patients, always have hope that we're going to make it better and better for our future generations.
Dr. Alfredo Quinonos Hinojosa is the chair of the Department of Neurologic Surgery at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. Doctor, thank you so much for your good work and for joining me today on the morning show. Best wishes.
Thank you, Greg, and thanks to your audience for listening to this.
Bye-bye.
The time is 8:44, and you're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, grappling with some technical difficulties this morning, but seem to be back on track now. Coming up at 9 o'clock will be National Public Radio's coverage of the impeachment hearings in Washington, D.C. Here's one more interview from the Morning Show archives to finish out today's program. And once again, it is my great pleasure and honor to speak with Rick Steves. And I'm sure many of you know his name well and the engaging way in which he writes about and speaks about the joys of travel around the world. I'm sure many of you have seen him on PBS and have read various books. On this particular occasion, I reconnect with Rick Steves to talk about a series of travel books, pocketbooks, really, in which you are given all kinds of great ideas about what to see and what to do in wonderful cities like Paris or London or Rome. We're going to talk with Rick Steves about the great care with which he has put these pocket guides together. A tour guide in your pocket is what it says on the back cover. And Rick Steves, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Can you just remind me, I think in our previous conversation we may have talked about this, but maybe you can just give us a reminder of how it is you got interested to such a rabid extent in traveling around the world.
Well, ever since I was a kid, I've been traveling in Europe. My dad used to import pianos from Germany, so he drags me over there as a junior high kid to see the piano factories and then, of course, to see the relatives in Norway. And at first, I wasn't that enthusiastic about it, but I got over there, and it occurred to me, you know, this is really cool. There's different candy, different pop. I remember statuesque women with hairy armpits. And a few years later, I realized I didn't need my parents to travel like that. I saw kids a couple years older than me with their rucksacks and rail passes, and I just thought, yeah, this will be my playground. So I've spent 3 months a year for the last 30 years in Europe. These days, I'm spending 4 months a year over there. First, I was traveling just for kicks. And then I started learning from my mistakes, and I thought if I could package the lessons I learned from my mistakes into a guidebook or something, other American travelers could learn from my mistakes and have a better, smoother, more economic trip, and I would have a good excuse to go back to Europe every year and update my material. So that's what I do. Well, that was 30 years ago, and now I've got a staff of 80 people, and we've got 30 guidebooks out, and I've got a great publisher. And, my guidebooks are the best-selling guides to every city and country in Europe. But my publisher explained, we're missing a very important part of that market, and it's this new trend in America to have small, colorful, portable versions of the big, heavy guidebooks. So these are the pocket guides. And, right off the bat, these are really resonating with the market. People like to, leave the hotel without a lot of junk, and they just stick this book in their pocket, and they've got the information they need to travel smartly.
Tell us about the challenge involved when you are dealing with, in a sense, a smaller template in which there is a whole lot of information that you're probably tempted to pour.
Yeah. Well, what we're assuming is the Americans have the shortest vacations in the rich world, so we're not listing, 10 days' worth of sites here. That's all found in my big 800, 900-page guidebooks to Rome or London or Paris. But these are, 230 pages each, and we have distilled it down to the predictable sites that people are going to want to see, and then we've covered these sites with huge depth so that people do not need to buy a guidebook when they get to the Orsay or the Eiffel Tower or Versailles or the, classical, the old center of Paris. So we've got these self-guided tours here that really are sort of a godsend to any traveler that's overwhelmed by Paris. Here you have five self-guided walks in the city or in its great sites, along with practical chapters on how to avoid the crowds and listings of hotels and restaurants and so on. One thing we've done, which is quite innovative, is we've made free audio tours versions of all of the major walks in these books. So you take any of the major walks or museums or palaces that you want to sightsee in Rome or Paris or London, and you can go to ricksteves.com or go to the App Store and get my Rick Steves Audio Europe app, and that gets you the audio tours where then you have free, at your access, beautifully designed self-guided audio tours, so you don't need to have your head buried in the book while you're out in the Sistine Chapel or walking around the Louvre or the Orsay or cruising the Grand Canal in Venice or whatever. You've got these audio tours that narrate it to you, so you're free just to be lost in the wonder of that space.
Fabulous, fabulous idea. How tricky was it to construct the specifics when it comes to these self-guided tours? And there's a number of them in each of these three pocket guides that I have before me. Talk us through the process by which you, I assume, really perfected each and every one of these tours.
Well, these have been 30 years in the making. For 25 years, I've personally led groups around Paris and London and Rome, and I was hiring local guides and finally got the nerve to do it myself. And then, you know, as a tour guide, you really develop a sixth sense of what people are interested in, what is their attention span, how many Madonnas and children can you show them until they don't care anymore. And, you know, you have to have variety, and you have to have a smart itinerary. You have to put things in historical context. Plus, you have lots of quirky little things that you want to drop in and see as you're walking around. So you got to design this into a tour, and then you've got to go over there and actually do it. When people really remark on how accurate our guidebooks are, it's because I'm personally there every year doing these tours, making sure when I say, you know, step over the street, walk down the little alley, and look up through that window, you'll see actually a guillotine in the bar. Well, you know, that's not necessarily going to be there next year, but the historic guillotine is in this little bar, and that way you can sort of have an intimacy in these tours. So it's a real, we're sticking our necks out to have people follow us so carefully, and we do it the old-fashioned way by updating these guidebooks in person every year, and they really work, and we take it seriously. My name's on the cover, and I want these books to be the best books out there, and it's just really fun tour guiding for me.
I'm sure. I have in front of me Paris, Rome, and London. Are these the first three, and at this point, only three pocket guides like this?
Yeah, we've covered all the major cities in Europe, and you know, I also have a tour company where we take 1 week tours to the big cities all around Europe, and it's clear to me from my tour experience what people are interested in doing according to what sells, and then when we do it, how do we spend the best week in each of these cities? And London, Paris, and Rome are far and away the best selling tour destinations for 1 week tours. They're the best selling normal guidebooks. So these are the books that we decided to do at the first whack at this new series with my publisher. From a sales point of view, I'm really happy with my publisher just knows how to sell books. I'm really lucky to be working with them. And, you know, we've got 30 books out, and our books are the best-selling books for every region in Europe, the best-selling France, Paris, Ireland, Spain, Italy, you name it. But we were missing a whole growing sales segment in this travel publishing industry, and that's called pocket guides. And they are, you know, they've got these, you know, you look at Fromer and Fodor and The Lonely Planet, and they have the big full-fledged guidebooks, which are my favorite guidebooks still, but they all find that the little companion book, whether it's called Top 10 or Day at a Time or Snapshot or Pocket Guide, these little companion guides that are full-color, shiny paper, slip it in your pocket, they've been selling as well as the big normal guidebooks. So right out of the starting gate, these three books are fourth, fifth, and sixth best sellers out of all 30 books. So, you know, this was a market segment we were just completely neglecting. And my publisher said, no, this is not going to take sales away from your big full-fledged Paris and Rome and London guides. This is a different market. And people are buying a Fromer book or a Fodor book or a Lonely Planet book because we don't have a book in that category. So from a, you know, just from a business point of view, it's really exciting to have these out. And we've got probably three more pocket guides in the works. Which are a fun thing to look forward to.
For three other cities, you mean?
Yeah.
Very good. You have included with each of them a pretty significantly sized pull-out map. And
right.
I think that's a wonderful idea. We don't always see that in guidebooks like this.
Right. Well, one thing I want to do is, because I'm over there 4 months out of the year. I'm a tour guide. I get a lot of feedback and suggestions and so on from my readers on the road. I was just over there for 2 months until a week ago working on these books. And I don't want people to get over there and have to buy things. I don't want them to have to buy a museum, a guidebook to Versailles. And if you go out to Versailles and you don't have it, you know, every guidebook lists it, but most guidebooks don't cover it room by room as I do. They don't give you the historical context as we do. They don't tell you how you can rent a bike and go out and explore the grounds and get out to Marie Antoinette's little hamlet where she dressed up like a peasant girl. You know, these sort of things I want to include in the book so people don't have to, out of desperation, buy it there at the site where you have to wait in line, where you have to buy a lousy, boring translated edition, and where you have to spend a lot of extra money. And the maps are something that people get, they really have a need for, and they end up buying them on the streets in Europe, and they're very expensive. And we design the maps ourselves. With new publishing technology, we can include them in the book quite economically. And these little pocket guides consequently come with a color map, and they're half the price of the normal guidebook. So they're cheaper. They really do it for somebody who's got a short visit to these sites and doesn't want to have you know, an exhaustive collection of all the restaurants and hotels, but just wants the very best listed. So yeah, it's really fun to try to figure out the market. And I'll tell you, Americans have the shortest vacations in the rich world, and it is really quite important not to overwhelm people with superlatives, but to cut right through that and say, if you've got 3 days in Rome, this is exactly how we'd spend them. One thing, Greg, that we've put on this in these books, which I think gives them an extra sort of value, we've included free audio versions of the tours in the books that you can just download on our app. And the app is entirely free. The Android version just came out, and you get it through the ricksteves.com website or at the App Store. And then that gives you carefully crafted, self-guided audio tours to all the major sites in Paris, Rome, and London, along with other great cities all over Europe. This has been very popular, so people don't have to have their head buried in the book when they're at St. Peter's Basilica or at the Sainte-Chapelle or out at Versailles. They can be lost in the wonder of that site with me as their tour guide in their ear. And for me, it's just a real fun way to amplify my teaching and to make it available in a way that's free and easy for people to use.
Hmm. These are really marvelous books. I can see how terrific they would be, and I anticipate seeing London for the first time in the next couple of years, and look forward to having this in my pocket with me. And again, these three pocket guides are all you need for a quick trip, a relatively quick trip to Paris, to London, or to Rome, each published by Avalon Travel. And Rick Steves, a great pleasure talking with you about these marvelously crafted books, and best wishes and safe travels to you.
Well, thank you so much, and get a hold of me before your London trip. I'd love to help you out.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we look forward to Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program. She'll have with her Dave Giordano from the Root Pike Watershed Initiative. On Friday, from the archives, Jim Murray and his touching and illuminating memoir called The Last Day of My Life. Next Monday, the 18th, we'll have for you a conversation with the leaders of the Kenosha Community Foundation and the Racine Community Foundation on what is the last day of Community Foundation Week, a celebration across the country highlighting the important work that community foundations do in communities like Kenosha and Racine. And next Tuesday, you'll hear an interesting conversation about a brand new book about fakes and forgeries and what it means to be real and what it means to be authentic. It's a book that investigates a number of different such incidents from the world of art and literature and even the collection of fossils. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org, and available as well as a podcast via all major podcast platforms. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. Today is going to be a cloudy, windy, cold day with a 50% chance of light snow, a high of 26 degrees with winds up to 20 miles per hour. Cloudy overnight, snow flurries, and maybe an inch of accumulation overnight with a low of 22 degrees. By tomorrow, Thursday, it should be partly sunny and breezy with a high of 33 degrees. Sunny on Friday and Saturday, both days a high of 36 degrees. Cloudy on Sunday and Monday, and both days a high of 39 degrees. And in fact, by next Tuesday, our extended forecast calls for sunshine and a high of 43 degrees. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR.